Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured. Not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and it's Saturday. Time to go into the vault. Now, this time we are going to be listening to part two of the episode from last Saturday, the episode originally from September 2017 that you and Christian did about Timothy Leary.
Yeah, we figured since we have the big psychedelic series that we've been putting out, you know, the new episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, it made sense to revisit these older episodes that explored some of the similar territory, you know, some similar history by focusing in on the life and death of Timothy Leary.
All right, so we hope you enjoy.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Christian Sager, and this is part two of our Timothy Leary LSD series of episodes. We've already done part one, where we talk about the basic science behind LSD and psilocybin and the research that's been done using these psychedelic substances. Then we talked about the first part of Timothy Leary's life leading up to his research on this.
Yes, that's right. So if you missed part one, go back and listen to it, because that's the one that's going to be front loaded with all that LSD science and just the initial period of Leary's life, which ultimately kind of sets the pace for the rest of his life.
Yeah,
like the self-destructive behaviors, the patterns. They're all pretty much present before he even finishes his education.
So I've been sitting around the house reading about Timothy Leary for the last couple of days, and my wife says out of nowhere, "You know, I met him, right?"
Yeah.
And I was like, "No, really?" We both went to college at the University of New Hampshire for undergraduate, and before I got there, but while she was there, either as a freshman or a sophomore. Timothy Leary came on one of his infamous campus speaking tours, gave one of his, you know, enlightenment talks. And then afterwards, my wife was outside the venue just like smoking a cigarette. And Timothy Leary came out and sat down next to her and just smoked a cigarette with her. And they chatted for like 5 or 10 minutes. And then he got up and went on his way.
What'd they talk about?
She didn't really say. She just said that like he was this kind of kind, cool, older guy.
Yeah.
But when I read about his life and all of the sort of women he went through, I can't help but imagine that he's the kind of like old, he was the kind of older man who leeringly went up to 18-year-old girls after talks and was like, let's talk about LSD, you know? Huh.
Yeah, one of the interesting things that Robert Greenfield points out in his biography, though, is that apparently, like, there's the Leary that we all imagine, which is often that that cool older guy, you know, with, yeah. With all this charisma. And certainly he seems to have had a certain amount of charisma his entire life. But there was this period where he was kind of like a just like a greasy guy with a mustache in ill-fitting clothing. Like, yeah. That was the version of him before his first wife died.
Yeah, right.
And it was after that that things begin to change, and he kind of morphed into this this more, the older, hip, cool Leary that we instantly imagine.
And this really all began at Harvard University, the place you would least expect it. So Leary joined Harvard University in 1959. But contrary to myth, I want to establish this because so many of the research got this wrong. He taught there, but he was not a professor there. He was not like a tenured faculty, okay? He was teaching there for sure. And he was part of the psychology department. Now, originally, his research there focused on the interaction of dimensions of personality and social relationships. He also did some work there as a psychotherapist. Leary was really anti-behaviorism, and he disagreed that psychologists should only concern themselves with observable behavior. This was the exact opposite of what was in trend at the time. He more wanted to explore thoughts and beliefs and other internal mental states. He actually later on would compare himself in this role to William James, who is understood as the father of American psychology, and who was also known to use nitrous oxide to stimulate mystical consciousness.
Well, so would Leary later on.
So at Harvard, along with a guy named Richard Alpert, who would later go on to become Ram Dass, you might know Ram Dass from the sort of infamous meditation book, I guess, called Be Here Now. So they worked together there in the psychology department. Leary introduced others on the Harvard faculty to psilocybin. And this, as we talked about last episode, is the active ingredient in certain species of mushrooms. And at the time, it was legally available for research. But what about his first experience with this stuff? Well, he takes psilocybin while he's on vacation in Cuernavaca, Mexico. He and some friends were on vacation in between semesters. They took some samples of mushrooms. And their argument for the research that they were doing, this is back at Harvard, was that if psychology is the study of the mind, then it should have a legitimate interest in how cognition, perception, and emotion are affected by mind-altering substances. So some argued at the time that they were also unaware of the potential dangers of such research, right? So because psilocybin and LSD were so new on the scene, especially in America, this team of psychologists, no matter how good intentioned they were, they weren't aware of what the drawbacks could be. And Leary and Alpert agreed to policies to protect their subjects. So this included no participation from undergraduate students. They were not supposed to be giving any kind of psychedelics to the undergraduate students at Harvard. But in 1963, Alpert was dismissed after he administered psilocybin to an undergraduate off campus, reportedly for sexual favors, although it's unclear whether or not that's true. So Leary begins administering these drugs to other researchers. He also administers it to a group of prison inmates and a group of divinity students for his research. This was called the Harvard Psilocybin Project. And the goal basically of this project was to document the effects of psychedelics on human consciousness. The notes from these studies were very carefully documented and scripted. And we know this because Timothy Leary's archives are pretty well maintained, and they're at the New York Public Library.
Yeah, in the various projects he was involved in, he was apparently very big on everyone providing him with lots of data, and was kind of a meticulous record keeper in that regard.
So let's take a little bit closer look at these studies that he did, okay? Let's look first at the one that he did with a group of divinity students. So this was called the Good Friday Experiment, and it went like this. They gave psilocybin to 10 students and 10 to a placebo group. All of them, then went to a Good Friday service. Huh. They wanted to see if this would facilitate any kind of mystical or spiritual experience. And in fact, 8 of the 10 reported a mystical experience. 1 reported a feeling of sacredness and a sense of peace. The placebo group, however, sat quietly through the service. The others would, quote, lay down or wander around the chapel muttering things like, God is everywhere, or, oh, the glory. What Leary failed to report in the study was that one of the subjects actually had a disturbing reaction and had to be given a dose of Thorazine to calm down. Now, you look back on this, that's a huge lapse of research ethics. That's not good.
Yeah.
So that's unfortunate. Now, Rick Doblin, who is the founder of MAPS, the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, he's come up on the show before. We talked especially about MAPS during our MDMA two-parter. He went back and he replicated this study, and he interviewed 7 of the 10 students involved, and they all said the experience reshaped their lives in profound ways. The student who reacted poorly actually said that he became convinced that he had been chosen to announce the arrival of the Messiah and ran from the chapel. So this is apparently what actually happened. He freaked out. He started running away from the chapel.
Well, that's a huge responsibility. I feel like you need to announce
the Messiah. Yeah, if he's going to announce the Messiah on Good Friday.
Yeah.
Of course, yeah.
Give me some advanced prep on that, got it? You know? Need some more prep time.
All right, let's talk about the Concord prison experiment next, okay? This is even wilder. So the aim here was to use psychedelics to reduce the recidivism rate in inmates.
Now, Leary was not interested in working with prisoners for a few different reasons, but he realized that he needed a way to measure the transformative nature of the drugs that he so believed in, and this offered the chance. So it seems like a decent argument, right? Could these substances open inmates up in a way that allowed them to discuss their conditions and their feelings? You know, someone who's just been hardened and calloused by crime, by life, and by incarceration, could this be the substance to just loosen them up enough to actually get some work done with them?
So over the course of 9 months, they used over a dozen convicts there as test subjects with psychedelics. Again, Rick Doblin replicated this study and reanalyzed it in 1998. He found that Leary's conclusion wasn't warranted. Leary's conclusion was the recidivism rate has been significantly reduced. But Rick actually found maybe not so much, Timothy Leary. The flaw was in the reporting results. He looked at recidivism rates 10 months after release for the psilocybin takers, but he didn't look at the same amount of time for the control group. He only looked at them 30 months later.
And this is important because recidivism depends a lot on time, with rates rising the more time one is out because of the increased opportunities. You know, when are you going to end up getting busted and end up going back to jail? Is it going to be the first day you're out? No, it's going to be in the weeks that follow as more and more temptations come.
Yeah, we've talked about this on the show, geez, many, many times, but this goes... It speaks to something called the halo effect, right? Mm-hmm. Where researchers start seeing their data in a positive light as much as possible. This becomes misleading. This actually seems to go beyond the halo effect, right? He's not just seeing his data in a positive light. He's manipulating the data so that it looks better than it actually is. So already here you see like these are basically his two big studies on using psychedelics medically in any kind of way, and he's either falsified his research or made huge gaps in ethical claims.
Now, Alpert would later explain that the aim of the project he thought was pretty solid and with a very reasonable therapeutic model. But he says it would have required long-term application and study, and Leary simply didn't have the patience for long-term studies.
You
can easily make the argument, well, then you're kind of in the wrong line of business here, right?
Yeah,
I mean, if you want to conduct a scientific study, if you want to really do the work, then you need to have the patience to see it through. And if you don't have the patience, you're going to end up with what we have here, a flawed study that ends up having to be thrown out later on.
Now, remember how I was saying that the The notes that he took during this time were meticulous. Wired magazine did a great article on Timothy Leary, and I pulled a quote directly from it. They said, "Later reports adhere less strictly to reality," meaning his reports. Mm-hmm. "In one, filled out in March of 1963, just weeks before he got kicked out of Harvard, Leary prints in big block letters. He puts down a question mark for his age and lists his occupation as Angel."
Okay, yeah.
So you can start to see that he's already unraveling here, right? So Leary eventually moves on from psilocybin, and he tries LSD in 1962 and then was dismissed from Harvard in 1963. Various faculty and administrators were essentially worried about the safety of their subjects, especially because Leary and Alpert were conducting their research while they themselves were under the influence of psilocybin. Psychologist Professor Herbert C. Kelman circulated a letter around the faculty and called for a meeting, calling for the trials to be voluntary. One of Leary's former students remembers that they had a choice at the end of the semester. They could either take their final or they could participate in psilocybin trials. Hmm. So it's interesting. That's an interesting choice to make.
It is an odd choice to give a college student.
So, okay, after all this stuff with the faculty, Leary was officially fired for failing to fulfill his teaching obligations because he went traveling instead. Ah. This is actually what they nailed him for, was that he wasn't teaching his classes. It wasn't the actual research that he was doing. He was just kind of like, I'm just going to travel instead of teaching my classes. And they were like, look, the job says teach the classes. You're not really doing the job. Sorry, you're done. Now, this is the moment where Leary and Alpert, though, are propelled into stardom because they get kicked out of Harvard, and that's a big deal, right? And they become proponents for psychedelics. Peter Connors writes this book called The White Hand Society about Leary and his relationship with Allen Ginsberg. And he says, this is really, there's a certain point, and this is it, where Leary gives up on science. Instead of looking for data to legitimize his psychedelic research, he started talking about spiritual enlightenment instead. This wasn't entirely his fault, because let's think about it. He had no adequate scientific language in place to do so. Instead, he fell back on hip poetic language that he picked up from hanging out with people like Allen Ginsberg and Charles Olson, and that really ended the field of psychology taking him seriously in any way.
But it also makes me think, like, ultimately, Leary, like, this is a guy who was better suited to be a shaman than a scientist. This is a guy who's better fitted to be this celebrity figure than an actual researcher.
Yeah. And now I have a lovely story before we end the Harvard stuff and jump into his time with the Millbrook Group. So William S. Burroughs is one of the people who actually denounced Timothy Leary the same thing. William S. Burroughs, obviously interested in psychedelics.
Yeah, author of Naked Lunch.
Yeah. He goes to visit Timothy Leary while he's at Harvard, and Burroughs gets there and he's like, where are the scientific studies? Like, I expected there to be mazes with rats running through them and electrodes and stuff. What? You aren't proving anything. All you're doing is just sitting around and getting high and enjoying yourself. So even William S. Burroughs was like, no, sorry. Like, I'm not buying this. So it makes you sympathize with this Harvard faculty crew who are like kind of painted throughout the history of psychedelics as just being these like stodgy old men, right? Mm-hmm. But like even William S. Burroughs was like, you're not really doing anything here.
Yeah, well, Burroughs is basically saying, I thought you were one of them, but you're just one of us,
right?
You know?
Yeah, exactly.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to move on to the next chapter in the life of Timothy Leary.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a Gagillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
All right, we're back.
So this is a great quote that comes from Louis Menand's New Yorker article on Timothy Leary, and I think it's a good segue into his time with the Millbrook Group. He says, "The only things Leary was serious about were pleasure and renown. He underwent no fundamental transformation when he left the academic world for the counterculture. He liked women, he liked being the center of attention, and he liked to get high." And then there's this is another quote from it. "He was a counterculture salesman, and he wore, on every occasion, the same blissed-out smile, a rictus somewhere between a beatific, what, me worry grin, and a movie star's frozen stare into the flashbulbs. One of his ex-wives described it as the smile of the ego actually eating the personality."
Huh.
Whew, that I can't think of a harsher condemnation. That's brutal. All right. So these guys get kicked out of Harvard.
Yeah.
That's where we left off, basically, right? Alpert and Leary, they go and they say, well, let's just establish our own privately funded research group, and we're going to call it the International Foundation for Internal Freedom. And it's going to be in Mexico. Basically, we'll get a bunch of people around the world to form groups. They'll take LSD and they'll report their results to us. It'll be kind of like citizen science.
Yeah, yeah, very scientific.
Unfortunately, the Mexican government wasn't having it. So they stepped in and they demanded that Alpert and Leary leave. So they leave. They've got no place left to go. Cambridge doesn't want them. Mexico doesn't want them. Well, where do they go? They go to this country estate in Millbrook, New York, that was provided to them by a millionaire who sympathized with their research in LSD. This is what we all need, man. We just need a sympathetic millionaire.
Yeah.
This millionaire was William Mellon Hitchcock, also known as Mr. Billy.
Huh.
Yeah. Mr. Billy was the grandson of the founder of Gulf Oil. This is where all his money came from. And at Millbrook, Leary established what he called the Castalia Foundation, which he said was dedicated to the scholarly study of LSD and its spiritual applications. So what's one of the things he does while he's there that's anywhere close to academic? He helps develop a device that's called the experiential typewriter. And this allows psychedelic subjects to record what they're experiencing as it's happening. Otherwise, they can't tell you. This is essentially him saying, I can't not be high while I'm doing these studies on people. So we need something that we can just hit buttons of to get across what's happening rather than have somebody who's in the room who can sort of translate it, right?
Like it's easier to have a special typewriter for people that are high than to have a single person that is not high in the room.
It seems to be okay. The case, yeah. Yeah, so this thing looked like an old adding machine. It had large buttons on it that had labels to indicate what kind of bodily sensations you were experiencing or if you were having hallucinations or you had a sense of entering the void. I'd love to see what the graphics for entering
the void. I think it would be an emoji, right? He was inventing an emojis-only typewriter.
You know what? Yeah, we're not giving him enough credit.
Yeah.
Timothy Leary invented emojis.
We wouldn't have the emoji movie if it were not for Timothy Leary to blame him for something else.
Okay. So then this thing, basically, after you're high, you pound on all these buttons, it prints out a little paper script that records what your trip was like. Some articles characterize the Millbrook group and Leary as actually not being as kind of like psychedelically crazy as you might think they were. They were sometimes depicted as being East Coast upper-class elitists and very exclusive. Now, Ken Kesey and his Merry Pranksters mm-hmm. came out there at one point. And they were like, oh, this is great. Let's go meet these psychedelic pioneers. And they're like, oh, man, these guys are just total stiffs. They're boring. So it's this interesting interaction between these two worlds.
Yeah, like because you tend to think, well, Leary would have just been able to move throughout the counterculture and that he would just be embraced everywhere.
Yeah.
But not so.
So during this time with Millbrook, Leary was convicted on several charges. This is when a lot of the prison stuff happens. It's all related to drug use and possession. The Millbrook house itself was raided, and Leary was arrested by who? G. Gordon Liddy.
Yes.
And at the time, G. Gordon Liddy was part of the county sheriff's department there in New York. Now, later on, he went to be part of the Watergate burglary, and he ends up kind of teaming up with Timothy Leary down the way.
Yeah, we'll get into that in a bit.
So this is, man, this is where things just really started getting bonkers, right? Millbrook and afterwards are just where things really let loose with Leary.
Yeah, now this is definitely a period where on one level, Leary and his bunch, they are being targeted.
You know? Totally.
On the other hand, you could also say, well, they're making themselves easy targets, but you eventually end up in kind of gray area there mm-hmm. when you're saying, well, you know, did he have it coming or not? But now this is certainly a period of time, though, where you can say that Leary and people in his circle were being targeted by the authorities. On the other hand, you might charge, well, they were kind of making themselves ideal targets for these forces as well.
Yeah. I mean, well, let's take this as an example, okay? So right after this raid happened, Leary goes down to New York, and at the Manhattan Town Hall there, he gives a talk, and there he says, LSD, it might actually be a problem. And he says, quote, LSD may be creating a new race of mutants. This is like the kind of hyperbole that he's starting to use in his rhetoric. Mm-hmm. He said he was going to stop using LSD and he urged others to do so. But he also advocated that LSD would cure alcoholism, accelerate learning, and may be helpful in treating all forms of mental illness. Well, as we know from the last episode, some of these things seem to be true. We just need to do more research on them. But because of its harmful side effects, Leary advised using other methods to produce psychedelic effects. So he says, you can just simply do this with the right lights, sounds, and a stroboscope. So he's basically like, yeah, just don't bother with the LSD anymore. Just like get in the right mood, man, and we'll like put the right kind of colorful lights in a room and things like that. And it's the same experience.
Well, this is a really – I found this to be a really interesting chapter in his life based on Greenfield's telling in the biography. And I do want to just drive home, like, Greenfield is not a Leary apologist. If anything, like, his book could have been titled Timothy Leary, a mess.
Right, right, yeah.
But he gives an interesting account of this. So in this talk – Leary prophesizes an evolution in human consciousness that will allow humans to consult their own heightened cellular consciousness and live in harmony with nature. So basically, like the abandonment of cities and everything, you know, is growing green again, and we're so like a new Eden on Earth.
Yeah.
You know, all, you know, sort of, you know, highly optimistic, sort of hippy-dippy kind of ideas, which one might expect. But then he calls for a one-year moratorium on LSD usage, and this is because of the changing legal status of LSD, and on the heels of all these various legal problems that he's encountering.
Mm-hmm.
And Greenfield points out that this was, quote, a calculated strategy to curry favor with the establishment. With the current level of LSD use in America having reached epidemic proportions, Tim wanted to restore his own credibility by becoming the man with a solution to the problem.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is really where we start seeing that he unfortunately made decisions for his own well-being over the decisions that may have, you know, helped highlight what these psychedelics were capable of and any kind of medical or mental health prospect, right?
Yeah.
And he really was self-serving.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned how he said, well, you can use alternate methods.
Right.
Well, he told everyone, well, if you've used LSD, then you maybe don't need it anymore. You can use alternate methods. And if you don't know alternate methods, I'll teach you. You know, this is a section—
For a price, I bet.
Well, but this is an area where I feel like Leary is correct. You know, we know that there are other ways to have hallucinatory experiences,
right,
including meditation, including things like yoga. So he's actually correct here. You know, his exact motivations aside, you know, he's saying, yeah, you can have some sort of heightened sense of being. You can have this alternate experience without the use of this substance that's becoming problematic. Now, he even goes on to testify before the Senate in 1966 on the nature of LSD. But this turns out to be a rather lackluster performance. So he wasn't very assertive, and I was reading the back and forth here, and there's just like a lot of stuff where he makes a statement, and then they're asking him are you being metaphorical or is that a literal statement? And they spend time discussing that. They talk about how LSD might theoretically be controlled in some fashion, but everyone was pretty much disappointed with how it came out. Like, he basically this was a point where Leary could really stand up and be the positive, optimistic voice of the counterculture and speak for this substance and speak for its research potential, and he wasn't able to come through.
I just imagine like people like John C. Lilly or Sasha Shulgin were like just sitting at home like face to palm, just like, oh, like, man, like, you were supposed to be the one that made this accessible for the rest of us, and now we're all screwed.
Yeah.
Also, I'm really glad Twitter wasn't around when Timothy Leary was alive. Can you imagine? He would have been insufferable on Twitter.
Yeah, probably.
All right. This is also around the time where he gives his infamous 1966 Playboy interview. This came up in every single article I read about him. So I went and I pulled the actual text and read the interview. This was, man, Playboy must have spent a lot of money on the sheets of paper that they printed this interview on, because it was like a novel. He makes some really outrageous claims here, including that women commonly can have several hundred orgasms during sex on LSD. So that doesn't seem to be true. No, again, fair enough. We haven't done that much research on it, but I'm pretty sure that's not true. Some other stuff he said, he talks more about that LSD ceasefire, basically saying that he thinks that the two generations that are, you know, battling over LSD right now need to just like cool off for a little while so that they can get to the point where they can start looking at it analytically. He also says like some frankly really misogynistic stuff here, not just about, you know, women and sex, but he says every woman has built into her cells and tissues the longing for a hero sage mythic male to open up and share her own divinity. But casual sexual encounters do not satisfy this deep longing. So he's really making these like huge mythic pronouncements, and it's just, I think in poor taste. Maybe in 66 it was taken as being sort of a little bit more eccentric and interesting.
Yeah, but certainly to modern readers, this does sound like the ego consuming the personality.
Now, this is this next quote is really one of the worst ones. He's asked about homosexuality, and he says, "The fact is that LSD is a specific cure for homosexuality. It's well known that most sexual perversions are the result not of biological binds, but of freaky, dislocating childhood experiences of one kind or another. Consequently, it's not surprising that we've had many cases of long-term homosexuals who, under LSD, discover that they are not only genitally, but genetically male." I don't even know what he's saying there.
Yeah.
That they are basically attracted to females. The most famous and public of such cases is that of Allen Ginsberg, who has openly stated that he... the first time that he turned on to women was during an LSD session several years ago. This is only one of many such cases.
Okay, so I have a lot of problems with all this.
Yeah. Obviously.
But, I mean, one of them is that it's not like Leary had numerous friendships and professional relationships with homosexual people.
Yeah, including Allen Ginsberg.
Yeah, and Dr. D was another one.
Right,
I mentioned, Tuscaloosa as being kind of this... the university there being this sort of fortress of liberal minds at the time, and a number of different homosexual professors, many of which had gone to bat for Leary and helped him with the connections he needed to navigate that portion of his life. So it just seems just completely ridiculous and disappointing to hear him talk about this.
Yeah, I mean, he's saying stuff that's like patently untrue. He has no evidence for that. But that, on top of all of it, he's throwing his friends under the bus.
Yeah.
You know? It's strange. And so really, this is the point where a lot of people feel like he helped hasten the blackout on psychedelic research. Because every time he had a stunt like this or the one where he gave that talk in the Manhattan Town Hall, it would just... accelerate the establishment's thoughts that, oh my God, we absolutely have to shut this down, right? So the Millbrook group goes on to disband, and Leary becomes a psychedelic speaker coach. And this is really the latter part of his life, what most people know him for. He's a public figure. He's associated with psychedelics and spiritual discovery. He even starts his own church called the League for Spiritual Discovery. He writes a bunch of books. In one segment that I read about this, a guy named Steve Silberman described Leary as a genius marketer during this time. And he says he could have had a brilliant career hyping up luxury cars, iPads, or social media startups. Instead, he was hawking LSD and psychedelic gnosis. And then in that same conversation, Connors, who wrote that White Hand Society book that I mentioned earlier, he responds and he says, Leary got caught in a circular trap of marketing himself so he could get money to then afford to defend himself from his prosecutors. So it's just all kinds of crazy stuff are going on. He gets pulled over in 1968. He's driving down Laguna Beach and he's arrested for drugs. His son was so stoned in the back seat that when they pulled him into the jail, he took off all of his clothes and started masturbating. When he was shown what his son was doing, Leary laughed. His daughter was sentenced to 6 months in prison. Jack was ordered to undergo psychiatric observation. Leary got 1 to 10 for possession of marijuana. So this is just one of many cases where he goes into jail and he gets out, right? He's described in the New York Times obituary. When he died, this is how the New York Times described him, as having an elegant, happy contempt for authority. And this is around the time where Richard Nixon infamously refers to him as the most dangerous man in America.
Yeah.
Again, hyperbole. Yeah. Everybody all over the place. Sounds a lot like right now.
Yeah.
People are just throwing out like this stuff that is just like super extreme. He talks to Marshall McLuhan during this period of time. This is when McLuhan advises him, yeah, you know what you should do? You need to come up with a catchy slogan to advertise the wonders of LSD. This is where we get turn on, tune in, drop out from. Basically, McLuhan saying like, you need to get better at brand marketing, dude.
I never thought that was a really great slogan for anything. I mean, the drop out part especially, it's just like, I don't want to try something that's going to make me drop out of something.
Right. Yeah. He basically becomes a celebrity during this time. I said this at the top of the first episode. This is where he becomes famous for being famous, right? He ends up associating and taking trips with, and I mean psilocybin trips, with authors, musicians, criminals, and movie stars, right?
Yeah.
And he just gets famous for hanging out with these people. In 1970, he declares his candidacy for governor of California. Who's he running against? Ronald Reagan.
Ah.
Now, this was interrupted when he was convicted on marijuana charges again. And he escaped. This is the craziest part of the whole story. He escapes prison. This is at San Luis Obispo. I guess that's a prison in California. And his followers help him get to Algeria. He essentially goes from Algeria to Switzerland and then to Afghanistan before returning to the United States in 1973. He eventually serves 3 more years in prison. But hold on. I just jumped over like 4 years of crazy behavior. Let's zoom in on this a little bit. Supposedly, his escape from prison was assisted by the Weather Underground.
Ah.
And in Algeria, he was the house guest of Eldridge Cleaver, who was part of the Black Panthers. They didn't get along, so he goes on to Switzerland. You know who he meets in Switzerland? Albert Hoffman, the guy who invents LSD. They sit down and have a conversation. But I also want to mention Greenfield, who we've been talking about this whole time. It's in Algiers where the two of them first meet up. So this is Greenfield's first experience with Timothy Leary is while he's on the run from escaping prison. When he returned to the U.S., here's the thing. He was facing way more jail time than 3 years, and he informed on all of his previous associates to the authorities. That includes his third wife, Rosemary. So he informed on her as well. She had left him during the middle of all this. He ends up writing articles for the conservative magazine National Review. And in these articles, he starts attacking John Lennon and Bob Dylan. And the reason why was he wanted to demonstrate that he had rehabilitated so they wouldn't put him back in prison.
And this again sounds like the classic pattern with Leary that the Greenfield points out, that he'll get on a kick where he's following a rigid system and adhering to some sort of a, you know, expectation of what he should be. But it's only going to last for so long.
Yeah, he turns around and bites the hand that feeds him. Yeah, yeah. So, okay. After this, he mainly spends time on the campus lecture circuit. This includes public debates with G. Gordon Liddy. This is like one of the most fascinating parts that we found in this entire affair here.
Yeah, the Liddy thing is interesting because both Leary and Liddy had become caricatures of themselves at this point. You know, inflated cartoon characters of liberal goofiness and conservative curmudgeonry. They even made a movie to capitalize on their fame or I guess to squeeze the last bits of juice out of it. And there's a 1983 New York Times review of the film by Vincent Canby, and he shares the following. I thought this was particularly telling. The two men are not exactly freaks, but one has the suspicion that they wouldn't be showing off in this way if they could possibly make a living in some other fashion. Whether accurately or not, the movie suggests that the world has passed them by and that this personal appearance tour is one of the last ways in which each can turn his individual notoriety to profit. Now, the reviewer also goes on to say that despite their personas, there is a scene in the film where each man and their current wives sit down and have breakfast together, and they're having just this a very normal conversation about just everyday stuff, like nothing about law or politics or drugs or counterculture. Like there is this moment where you see this idea that they're perhaps just two people who are just trying to make a living for the time being, and this is what they have.
This would have been like if Steve Bannon and Lindsay Lohan went on tour together or had like a reality TV show together where they just constantly argued.
Yeah, and if neither had a significant enterprise to back them up at that point.
Right, yeah.
It's kind of – I get the impression that it's kind of like it's kind of like celebrity TV. If this had happened today, it would have been a Leary and Liddy television show on some reality network.
Right, them trying to learn how to dance better than one another.
Exactly, yeah.
All right, why don't we take one more break, and then when we get back, we're going to talk about the end of Leary's life and his focus on, of all things, cybernetics.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay. Picture this, it's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road, the steeper the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai. There's joy in every journey.
All right, we're back.
So we've talked a lot on our show before about cyborgs and cybernetics and transhumanism and what that has to do with space travel. It turns out Timothy Leary in his 70s became fascinated by all this stuff, specifically electronic communication. And he would tell his audiences that electronic communication was going to be what would free their brains and souls from oppressive orthodoxies like education, religion, and politics. In particular, he was fascinated by things like virtual reality, computer games. He even went so far as to start his own software company before he died.
He also predicted that implanted septal electrodes would one day be used recreationally. And we're not quite there yet, but it just goes to show how interested he became in the role technology could play in alternate states of awareness.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I'm quite there with Timothy Leary on this one. Because we are now in an age where electronic communication is so vast. Like I said earlier, he would have been insufferable on Twitter. I can't imagine. I can't imagine what this would be like. And I don't know necessarily that these technologies have enabled us to break free of oppressive orthodoxies like education, religion, and politics. But hey, there's still time, right? I mean, it's only been like 20 years since he passed away. Speaking of which, so he died in 1996 at his home in Beverly Hills, California. He was 75 years old. Interesting thing about this is outside of his fascination with psychedelics and electronics, his other fascination was with death and out-of-body experiences near death. So this was something that he turned into a public performance as well. He made it an event. He had video cameras record his death. He built the whole thing up from a year before when he was first told that he was diagnosed with prostate cancer. And his friends collected his writings and his papers all on a Leary-themed website, and they posted films of him there. He even recorded his daily drug intake on this website. It was basically a blog before there were blogs. Now, I want to recap here. Let's return. Just, we've been hitting on this over and over and over again throughout the episode, how self-destructive he was. He went through two divorces. He went through one separation. His first wife committed suicide. His second wife, who was the mistress that he left his first wife over and who she committed suicide over, that woman left him after he struck her and their landlady called the police on them. And then his daughter also committed suicide in 1990. So he left this wake of broken people behind him. It just doesn't leave a good taste in my mouth.
Yeah, that was my experience with the research as well. I didn't go into this idolizing Leary, but I went into it like appreciating some of the things he's said before and the use of his persona in various bits of fiction or music. And it was disappointing to really not only to see this pattern, but to spend a lot of time reading about it.
Yeah, I think like after he had been like, you know, he's been mythologized over the years, especially for our generation. I expected more.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, a lot of, you know, I noticed that a lot of people were kind of critical on Amazon, for instance, of the Greenfield biography.
Oh, really?
Because they thought, you know, it's like, oh, he's just kind of a hatchet job or whatever. But I think the thing is that the biography reveals more about the real Timothy Leary than a lot of people, you know, were comfortable confronting.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, he's dying, as you said, and he's keeping a track of the various substances he's taking. So Leary actually considered taking LSD on his deathbed, and this would in doing this, he would have been following the lead of Aldous Huxley, who took an injection of 100 micrograms on his deathbed. Now, in the time leading up to his death, Leary did use ketamine and enhanced it with nitrous oxide. He drank. Toward the end, there was a lot of smoking, especially. Carol Rosen, a friend who is at his bedside, said that his penultimate words were, "Why not? Why not? Why not?" Repeating the final question 50 times in different voices. And then, according to his son, he said, "Beautiful," and died.
Huh. Okay. Part of me is very cynical and has to wonder how much of that was performed, given that he knew that the cameras were on and everything.
It's true. Yeah, this is true. Now, he had pursued cryonic suspension at one point, but his final wishes were that his cremated remains be distributed among his friends as well as shot into space. So indeed, a year later, 7 grams of his ashes in a vial went into space on a Pegasus rocket. And this, by the way, was the rocket that also contained 7 grams of ashes from a few other notable individuals, including Gene Roddenberry. Now,
so how do you buy into that ahead of time, or does somebody sponsor you? How's that work?
I think in Leary's case, it was a sponsorship situation.
Okay.
Now, Greenfield in his biography sums everything up, I think, rather succinctly at the end. He says, "A self-proclaimed cheerleader for change who himself had never been able to change, Timothy Leary had finally achieved his heart's desire. In death, as he could never be in life, he was not only free but soaring through the heavens at which he had gazed so often in wondering during his most improbable life."
That's a very nice eulogy, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it also just sums up you know, a lot of the disorder that was there as well.
Yeah, absolutely. But it paints him in a nicer picture than I think, honestly, maybe we have in the last two episodes of the show. We've been trying. I really wanted to give him the benefit of the doubt, you know?
Yeah, same here. Yeah.
So actually, I mentioned this earlier, but Leary's archives are today stored at the New York Public Library. Reportedly, the library paid $900,000 for them, and a portion of that, just to be clear, went back toward processing the collection. These archives had an interesting life before they showed up at the library because they were moved from place to place so that they could avoid the FBI seizing them. And they actually... it did end up getting seized by the FBI regardless. And then they were returned. They ended up in a storage facility in California until 2010. Now the library houses his documents alongside George Washington, Herman Melville, and Truman Capote.
So in closing, there was definitely a lot more chaos and disorder in Leary's life than I anticipated going in. Again, not being very familiar with the details of his life, just sort of having a pop culture awareness of him and a media filtered awareness of him. It ended up being at times a depressing journey to read more in detail about his life and his work.
Yeah, I agree. The New Yorker review of the Greenfield biography that we use for a lot of this compares him to Wilhelm Reich, who we also have an episode on. And they basically say, look, they were both renegade psychologists who became brand fads among quote unquote enlightened people. To me, Leary seems to be more like a sly huckster than any kind of contributor to philosophy or psychology. Like I said, that's unfortunate. I guess I just expected more. The Don Latin book, The Harvard Psychedelic Club, which I also read through, refers to him as the trickster throughout the book. Like they give a sort of like mythical status to each of the characters from the Harvard Psychedelic Club. Uh-huh. Richard Alpert or Ram Dass gets the term the seeker, but Leary is the trickster.
So he'd be kind of like the Loki of this Avengers?
Yeah, it seems like it, yeah. I had a hard time reading all this research and not seeing a selfish kind of egomaniacal guy who seemed to sacrifice all of his family and friends along the way just so he could extend his 5 minutes of either fun or fame or both. Yeah. I don't know. So yeah, it was really disappointing, unfortunately. I'm curious. I'm sure that there are plenty of people who are listening to this episode who are real devout, you know, fans of Leary and his wisdom. And maybe there's something that Robert and I are missing out on here. I don't know.
Well, I will say this, and to sort of, you know, end it on a positive note. Yeah, Leary's words have definitely inspired me in the past, and I think I'll continue to find inspiration in some of his words. One of the weird things that happens with icons, celebrities, and even prophets is that there emerges this disconnect between self and perception, between actuality and the ideal. So, you know, the pop culture Leary here is, I think, something of a fiction, but it can serve as a beneficial fiction, I think, at times. So I'd like to close out here with a quote that I've always valued and one that I tend to sort of employ as a guiding principle for stuff to blow your mind.
Okay.
So I'll read it once again in my impersonation of Timothy Leary. Throughout human history, as our species has faced the frightening, terrorizing fact that we do not know who we are or where we are going in this ocean of chaos, it has been the authorities, the political, the religious, the educational authorities, who attempted to comfort us by giving us order, rules, regulations, forming in our minds their view of reality. To think for yourself, you must question authority and learn how to put yourself in a state of vulnerable open-mindedness, chaotic, confused vulnerability to inform yourself.
Now that I can agree with.
Yeah, that I think that lines up with how we tend to approach topics here.
Yeah.
How I think we should always approach any kind of authority figure, even when that authority figure is Timothy Leary.
So hope you enjoyed this marathon of Timothy Leary and LSD information that we gave you this week. We are probably going to be doing a Facebook Live Trailer Talk event the day after this episode releases. So if you're listening the day of, go to our Facebook page. That Friday morning, we'll probably be on Facebook Live talking about movies that are related to Timothy Leary and or LSD and psilocybin.
Yeah, some sort of psychedelic cinema celebration. We haven't figured it out yet, but it'll probably be more fun than the details of Leary's life.
Yeah, maybe so. If you want to contact us or follow us on that or find out when that's happening, we're all over social media. We'll try to post in advance, let you know what the timing is on that. We're on Facebook, we're on Twitter, we're on Tumblr, and we're on Instagram.
And if you want to get in touch with us the old-fashioned way, just shoot us an email at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.